Okay, so try 22 left, 39 right.
2 left.
45.
No.
Right.
That didn't do it.
Well, what about 38 left, 26 right,
38 left?
Yes, 26 right.
26.
38 left again. Just go with that.
No, that didn't work either.
What about 27 left?
Are you just making these numbers up? Are you just pulling them out of the air?
Oh, look, the podcast. Podcast. John Hodgman here with Jonathan Colton.
Hi.
And we're cracking a safe here at the Little Gray Book.
Yes, we are.
Lecture podcast number 7, which pertains to Little Gray Book lecture number 31 on the subject of how to commit the perfect crime. And appropriately enough, we're cracking a safe.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would call this the perfect crime. We've had some rough spots, sort of.
Yeah.
We had trouble with the digging, and then the water, and then the alarm. The robot spiders didn't work out as expected. I'm the first to admit that. And why don't you explain why we're cracking the safe?
Well, just let's go back to the robot spiders for a second, because when you say they didn't work out as expected, when we broke into Galapagos in order to do this lecture on the perfect crime, one of your robotic spiders that you had designed based on your expertise in robot building tripped an alarm. And we had to find a refuge in a place where no one would look for us.
Yeah.
And so we snuck into the walk-in vault at Galapagos, where they keep all of their many thousands of bodega votive candles.
Yeah.
And
kind of stinks in here.
And naturally, you know, well, it's a beautiful collection.
I mean, it stinks of wonderful aromas, I guess.
It's probably the best collection of candles in New York City. And that's why they have their vault on an automatic locking mechanism. So we're stuck in here.
So we're actually trying to crack out of the safe.
By candlelight.
Which I'm not sure we should be doing that. Is there probably a limited air supply in here?
I just consider it to be motivation.
Yeah, it is that, isn't it?
Because the show is coming up. It's June 16th at 7:30 p.m. So we've got to hurry up.
Right. We only have a little bit of time.
Yes. So maybe you should try some more numbers.
All right.
And rather than bore people with numbers, we could play them some segments from the last Little Gray Book lecture, which took place around President's Day in 1890. And it was on the subject of how to observe President's Day, observed. And we had a number of very fine readers and performers and singers discussing presidential matters. So, do you want to keep working on that, and I'll start the tape?
Yeah, I'll keep trying random numbers, I guess.
But I don't know how to get the tape to go.
So. Oh, well, why don't I just punch it up here?
And then you'll get back to the numbers.
And I'll get back to the numbers.
Okay, great. I'll think up some more numbers in the meantime.
Here we go.
All right, well, now, by now we all recognize the man at the bar, George Washington. First President of the United States. But I bet that very, very few of us would recognize another man who is coming up from behind me here. Yes, this is John Hanson. And in case you don't know, and you probably don't, John Hanson is the first President of the United States. And the fact that you don't know that, or perhaps have been prevented from knowing that, is a big problem that a big man named Nick Pays Jr. is trying to solve. Mr. Pays owns and operates the Presidential Museum in the tiny crossroads town of Hartsgrove, Ohio. It's the one and only presidential museum in the history of the world, according to Nick Pays Jr. Now, it turns out that the only reason that we believe George Washington is the first president is because we've never visited the Presidential Museum in Hartsgrove, Ohio, and had Nick Pays tell us the truth. Now, the Presidential Museum sets the record straight. I was there about a month ago. It not only gives the proper credit to President Number 1, John Hanson over there, but to Presidents 2 through 8, who happen to be Elias Boudinot, Thomas Mifflin, Richard Henry Lee, John Hancock, Nathaniel Gorham, Arthur St. Clair, and Cyrus Griffin. Now, three obvious questions come to mind. Who is John Hanson? Who are all those other guys? And wasn't George Washington the first president of the United States? Well, here are the facts, quickly, because they are kind of dull. John Hanson became president in 1781, 9 years before George Washington. There is a catch, of course. He did it under the Articles of Confederation, which was America's constitution before we had a constitution. The other seven guys followed him once a year up until 1790, until the founding fathers dumped the dysfunctional Articles of Confederation and gave us the constitution that we have today. Yes, that's, they did that. And we are still suffering for it. Now, Nick Pace Jr. At the Presidential Museum has a problem with that. His museum, which he opened in 1989, is designed to right that terrible wrong. Now, you don't get a quick explanation when you visit the Presidential Museum. Instead, you get Nick Pace Jr. hitting you with these rhetorical broadsides, such as,
"Our current Constitution, I'm a doctor, and I'm also a professor. The point is simply this. I do know the law. The point is simply this. The law is this. When you make up a law, our current constitution, which is the federal constitution, was ratified September 17th, 1787. Didn't go into effect until 1790. Look in any library. George Washington didn't come into play until 1790. How could he possibly be our first president? All the history books in the library so state that."
Now, Nick's roundabout way of putting things isn't really a problem, because you don't visit the Presidential Museum to understand Nick Pace Jr. You go to bask in the glory of Nick Pace Jr. He will subject you to withering salvos of rhetorical questions.
You follow me? You see my point? Now, do you understand?
And it doesn't matter how you answer. Nick will explain it anyway. Nick has done the research. Nick knows what he's talking about. Nick is smarter than you. Now, it's difficult to know where Nick's indignity ends and his self-glorification begins. He wears a large medal around his neck that he claims was given to him by the government of Ireland. He has dozens, and I mean dozens, of spiral binders full of official-looking letters awarding him a Medal of Honor for this or a Man of the Year for that. And one in particular, which is embossed in gold, declares that Nick is one of the great minds of the 20th century, along with Einstein, Gandhi, and Mother Teresa.
"I'm no crackpot, and I'm not a religious fanatic, and also I got nominated for the Nobel Prize last year."
Now, for those of you who were not aware that Nick Pace Jr. was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize last year, he has an explanation.
"They only publicize the winners."
Now, the first floor of Nick's museum is a bar. All right, he sells Presidential Museum beer. Upstairs is a large room cluttered with posters, books, news clippings, photos, assorted presidential tchotchkes. The walls are crowded with portraits of all the presidents. And the biggest portrait is not of John Hanson. It is not of George Washington. It is of Nick Pace Jr.
"My great-grandfather was king of Bohemia. King Studnicka. My mother was born in Prague. Her mother was raised as a princess. I questioned my mother and found that it was corrupt over in Europe. And if it was corrupt over there, it had to be corrupt over here. And that's when I knew that George Washington wasn't our first president. When I was 7.
Nick has poured 50 years of research into a book titled What Every American Should Know. It's not available in any bookstore or any library, but he sells it at the bar. He calls it the truest history book ever written.
And those are not my words. a publisher in Indiana. I published the book myself. She put 3 pages on her website so stating the fact, truest history book ever written.
Nick sent the first copy of his book to the King of Sweden, who was the man who nominated Nick for the Nobel Peace Prize. He reserved the second copy for George W. Bush, but George W. Bush never answered Nick's certified letter. Now, does that bother Nick? No, because Nick is just toying with George. Nick knows that George will never respond because George knows that Nick knows the truth. Now, Nick believes that the reason that we don't know about John Hansen is not because John Hansen is this hopelessly arcane footnote in American history. It's because the government doesn't want you to know about John Hansen.
The point is, the less you know, the easier it is for you to be controlled. True history has not been taught in this country in the last 40 years. The truth is our only salvation, and the government should quit lying to us.
Nick then lowers his voice and says,
I trust nobody.
Now, one thing that we do want to know is why this very important museum is all the way out in Hartsgrove, Ohio, otherwise known as the middle of nowhere. Nick Pace Jr. is not from Hartsgrove. John Hansen is not from Hartsgrove. He's not even from Ohio. So why is it in Hartsgrove? Well, Nick is kind of vague about that. He says that the building is 200 years old, it's a tavern, the Articles of Confederation were written in a tavern, and so it's symbolic. But at the same breath, he tells me that he expects to get $3.5 million from a secret benefactor so that he can move to a bigger place, someplace other than Hartsgrove, Ohio. So, we have John Hansen, we have Nick Pace Jr., unappreciated men, toiling in obscurity, overlooked by history. Nick could pack it in. He could get a job somewhere. Maybe. But he chooses not to. He chooses to stand up for what he believes in, to sell his beer, to win his awards, and to fight for the first president of the United States, John Hansen.
My job is to give people a choice. You want to honor George Washington? Be my guest. I'm not going to chase you out of here with a gun saying, please believe me. Check the facts for yourself. But once you check the facts and you still want to believe it, you're a raving maniac.
Oh, hi. Oh, my. John has actually stepped away for a couple of moments. He went off into the safe, deeper into the safe, and I haven't seen him in a little while. I'm not sure. I don't usually know how to do this. John? John? Anyway, that was Ken Smith and Dave Guillaume as John Hansen speaking the words of Nick Pace Jr., and let me see if I can just figure out what else John wanted to say in the podcast.
Yeah, Jonathan, I'm back here. I'm back.
Oh, hi. What?
I found a small antechamber here in the vault. And
yeah.
I found some things that actually might help us. That was great, by the way. I was listening to the podcast.
Yeah, it was really good.
So I have a stethoscope that'll help us crack the safe.
Oh, because I can listen for the tumblers tumbling.
And I found some rubber gloves.
Oh, okay.
And a velvet suit,
okay,
and a George Washington costume. I think that's ours, actually.
I guess some of those might be helpful.
And here's an enormous and extremely noisy ice making machine.
Oh, that's awesome!
I think you see where I'm going with this.
I think I do.
Yeah, and here's some old music stands,
uh-huh,
and a broken mirror.
Great.
And
we can build
an old bottle of wild turkey rye, which I think was also ours originally.
Well, at least we have that.
Yeah. So,
I still have not made much progress.
What we need to do is make these things into a carbon dioxide scrubber so that we can breathe, so that we can continue to crack the safe.
It is getting a little thin in here,
isn't it? It's getting a little A little bit, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, you saw Apollo 13, right?
Yeah, I didn't
know. They were using mostly these sorts of things to make a carbon dioxide scrubber.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
And you write for Popular Science magazine, so maybe I was thinking you could do that while I listen to Joshua Bearman.
Yeah.
So you want to get to work on that?
Yeah, should I start the Joshua Bearman thing for you, and then I'll go to work, and you can sit here and
yeah,
listen?
No, that's a good idea. I'm glad you're here. Let me just say, Joshua Bearman spoke also about presidents on our President's Day lecture, and he had a lot to say about Theodore Roosevelt, who was a president, and also one of the early sighters of the Sasquatch.
Right.
Okay, now you can start that.
I'll start and this, then, and then I'll get back to work.
If you can do that and also work, maybe just keep trying numbers on the safe. I'll generate the numbers.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Definitely.
Thanks for that introduction. And thanks, everybody, for sticking around. Can everybody hear me all right? I'm going to read. This is going to be an adaptation from an upcoming McSweeney's publication, which is called Yeti Enthusiast. And Yeti Enthusiast is a lifestyle guide for the backyard beginner on up to the seasoned expedition leader alike. So says our, this is our mission statement. The presentation is actually a couple of articles combined, and it's called Foe and Friend, Teddy Roosevelt and the Sasquatch. And I should point out, this is a work of nonfiction, as with all Yeti research. But I'm serious, this is nonfiction. Okay, so we start in 1884. Theodore Roosevelt, age 25, is already a successful New York legislator and crusader against corruption. He was also a world-class hunter, having transformed himself from a spindly child into a robust outdoorsman. That summer, Roosevelt headed out into the Dakota Territories for a month-long safari in the American West. Roosevelt brought down 170 animals, from bunnies to bears, but he may have been looking for something more out in the woods. In addition to shot placement guides for bear and ungulates, Roosevelt brought with him a Royal Society publication including new anatomy charts for the recently discovered African gorilla. And he was unusually well-armed, carrying, according to his own manifest, a number 10 choke bore, 300 cartridge shotgun, two 45-75 Winchester repeaters, a 40-90 Sharps, and the incomparable 50-150 Webley Express. Roosevelt had always extolled the huntsman's journey into what he called the borderland between savagery and civilization, where our ancestors led furtive lives among terrible beasts. Pointing to Roosevelt's mode of equipment and other evidence, many Bigfoot scholars suggest that the future president may have sought the greatest beast of them all. Or, as Grover Krantz, the wayward anthropologist who later became one of the world's foremost Bigfooters, put it, when T.R. went into the woods, he was always double-barreled and loaded for Sasquatch. Fueling speculation about Roosevelt and Bigfoot is his own telling of a face-to-face encounter. It appears in Roosevelt's compilation of frontier tales called The Wilderness Hunter, which was published in 1893. And we have a slide of that. There's the book, Roosevelt, Hunting Regalia. There, Roosevelt recounts a story of a mysterious frontiersman named Bauman, who was stalked in the Bitterroot Mountains by, quote, some great goblin beast. Bauman and a companion, the story goes, had bivouacked in an open glade. At midnight, these are Roosevelt's words here now, Bauman was awakened, and it gets spooky, by some terrible savage noise and sat up in his blankets. His nostrils were struck by a strong wild beast odor, and he caught the loom of a great body in the darkness at the mouth of the lean-to. Grasping his rifle, he fired at the threatening shadow, but must have missed, as the thing, whatever it was, rushed off into the blackness of the night. And I think which apparently isn't playing. It's terrifying. There's like 90 minutes more of that, by the way. This is from a record in the Sierras by two Bigfoot hunters in the 70s. It's on Sierra Sounds label. And I can tell you where to get it after if you need to know. There's all different states of Bigfoot sort of distress there. Okay, so later the beast kills Bauman's partner. Bauman returns from tending to beaver traps and finds his friend with a broken neck.
The creature, Roosevelt wrote, had not eaten the body, but apparently had romped and gambolled round it in uncouth, ferocious glee. In scholarly Bigfoot circles, this text is vital. It's one of the earliest Bigfoot records, presidential or otherwise. Since the story does come from such an esteemed source, the Wilderness Hunter forms part of the canon of Bigfoot documentation. Russell Woods, West Coast liaison for the Bigfoot Field Research Organization, said that Roosevelt's story is very important because you can tell that it was observed. It really sounds, he said, exactly like what would happen if two trappers ran across the kind of hominoid creature known in that region. The importance of the story is echoed by Michael Grimley, author of the research volume There Are Giants in the Earth, Survivors Since Genesis. I think that speaks for itself. Grimley takes a biblical approach not only to the Sasquatch, but also to its historiography. He calls the Roosevelt story the last great chapter of the early Bigfoot narrative, the Deuteronomy, if you will, of the Bigfoot Old Testament. Going a step further, Christopher Murphy's Meet the Sasquatch draws a direct nexus between Roosevelt's story and the infamous Osman incident, which occurred years later but in the same area. That was when a young man named Albert Osman was abducted in his sleep by a pod of Sasquatches. That's the technical term. It's a pod. Causing a brief sensation in local newspapers. Osman eventually freed himself, he said, by enticing the lead male to eat an entire can of snuff. And he escaped in the ensuing confusion. Entering the realm of literary criticism, Murphy also notes that the dread of Roosevelt's story is well known from similar tales about the Wendigo. And the Wendigo, for those who don't know, was the better-known term for Bigfoot about 100 years ago. The name comes from Algonquin and other Indian lore. Advancing his point, Murphy cites Ogden Nash's 1923 stanza about the Wendigo that poetically articulates the creature's dread, which I will cite briefly here. The Wendigo, its eyes are ice and indigo. Its blood is rank and yellowish, its voice is hoarse and bellowish. Its tentacles are slithery and scummy, slimy, leathery. Its lips are hungry, blubbery, and smacky, sucky, rubbery. The Wendigo, I saw it just a friend ago. Last night it lurked in Canada, tonight on your veranda. Ogden Nash. That's, you know. Clearly some poetic license, because everybody knows that Bigfoot by no name has tentacles. So many Bigfoot scholars also note that there is no external record of Roosevelt's Bauman character. For them, this casts no doubt on the story. Rather, it suggests that Roosevelt had in fact recorded his own experience. If Bauman was not real, says the moderator of the Crypto Forums, which is the clearinghouse of Bigfoot discussion online, it's because Roosevelt created him as a proxy for his own eyes. Wanting more background on this possibility, I called Lauren Coleman, noted cryptozoological investigator and two-time winner of the Bigfooter of the Year award. Coleman, a retired professor in Gorham, Maine, made his name in Sasquatchery as the author of a field guide to Bigfoot, the Yeti, and similar creatures like this next slide. Now, there's about 200 drawings in the book. This is the only one with no face. And there's just one more that I'd like to point out. So you see the spectrum of the themed folio. I don't even know what that is there. 5 feet tall, though. Coleman now spends his time preparing Bigfoot lectures and providing guidance to, quote, serious expeditions only, which he affirmed to me several times could be arranged at a moment's notice because Gorham, Maine is serviced by what he called an international jet port. Yet, Coleman was ambivalent towards the Bauman story. It was probably just a bear, he said. About the theory that Roosevelt was the one stalked by the creature, he said, oh, there's lots of theories out there. Some of these guys will believe anything. For one thing, Coleman added, the Roosevelt story talks about 2-foot-long prints. Everyone knows Bigfoot tracks are 20 inches long at most. But many active Bigfoot hunters say that Coleman is just an academic, that he'll never see Sasquatch up in his ivory tower. That if you understand real field work, it's clear what Roosevelt was up to. Anyone familiar with the armaments of the period, said a Texas Bigfoot tracker who called himself Hunster, knows that Roosevelt carried far more firepower than what's needed for bear, which is true, we recall from Roosevelt's arsenal on the Dakota trip. Hunster also emailed me a PDF of an article Roosevelt wrote in 1906 describing a supposed grizzly hunt. But the detail, Hunster says, really resembles more of a Bigfoot-type experience. And he helpfully highlighted the passages there, which I'll spare you this detail, but know that according to Hunter, this all sounds very, very familiar to dedicated Bigfooters across the country. Which makes, Hunster said, Roosevelt, Hunster said, the original Bigfoot hunter in the Americas. And you can bet, he added, poignantly, that if TR came across the big guy out there, he was going to take him down. Roosevelt would have laid the kill controversy out flat before it even started. And so for those of you unfamiliar with the kill controversy, I'll fill you in. Because the Bigfoot research realm, my friends, is in tumult. The dividing line runs from Bigfoot symposia on down to weekend Sasquatch societies. Because the question is so central. What is your tactical, and then by extension philosophical, approach to the eventual encounter with the creature itself? The kill camp says, shoot the Bigfoot! Because, the argument goes, the world will only believe in the creature when there's a corpse. Grover Krantz, the wayward anthropologist we met earlier, was one of the earliest to propose the scientific value of killing a Bigfoot. We need a type specimen, he wrote in his 1986 masterwork, Big Footprints. There's no other method for taxonomic verification. If you see a Bigfoot, kill it and cut off the biggest piece you can carry. Be sure to bring back the jaw. Even without such evidence, Krantz defied scientific practice by suggesting a genus name for the creature, raising many eyebrows among his anthropology department colleagues. Gigantopithecus was his speculative designation, reflecting the theory that Bigfoot is a relic population of the very real but long since extinct Gigantopithecus apes that stood 10 feet tall and roamed Asia prehistorically. We have a slide. Yeah, that's real. Giganto is known from the fossil record. There he is. That's a true size comparison. I'm not sure who he's waving at there. So determined was Krantz to find his Bigfoot specimen that he advocated mounting a military-style strike force of armed men lined up for 60 miles spaced 10 feet apart, advancing slowly across Washington's Olympia Valley because, he said, that way we'd get one for sure. The no-kill Bigfooters, who are probably the majority, view this kind of approach with horror. They say that Bigfoot is our Sylvan ally, that he's gentle and deserves our protection. The Bigfoots they know usually shy away from campers and forest visitors, or at worst, alarm them by trying to make friends. One man I talked to said that when he was backpacking near Lancaster and saw a Bigfoot, he was at first scared, but when he decided not to run, Bigfoot came closer and gave him a crystal. It was 1978. If you want to prove Bigfoot's existence, he said, look into your heart. There's also, I should mention, a small schismatic faction that says that the kill controversy is moot because Bigfoots cannot be killed by mere humans since they are, in fact, trans-dimensional shapeshifters. And that's the paranormal group. That's a whole separate... They'd be very upset by, really, most of what we've shown here already. More authoritatively, people like Jane Goodall have publicly said that mainstream primatology does not need a dead Bigfoot for proof. film, observation, or capture would do. The no-kill group is itself split between those who prefer peaceful observation, a la Diane Fossey, and a more aggressive branch that wants to catch one of the creatures alive by building traps in the woods. And there are a few of these traps, actually, secret locations. And according to various trapping guidelines, beef jerky and peanut butter are recommended baits, both apparently found to be quite savory by Bigfoot. The no-kill camp sees the hunters as mercenaries. They're in the Bigfoot game for the glory, says Chester Moore. Moore heads the Mystery Primate Conservation Alliance. And he says, we're here to prove this thing is for real and protect it at the same time. Moore has a new book out, described in the press release as a bold declaration about how to share North America with this fascinating species. The book is called Bigfoot Lives. Deal with it. Moore also claims that it's illegal to shoot a Bigfoot, which is partially true. Bigfoot has been listed since 1977 in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Environmental Atlas. We know what camp you're in. That same year, there was a memo circulating around Fish and Wildlife about whether to cover Bigfoot under the Endangered Species Act, but they held off for lack of a formal description. Not wanting to wait for the feds, several Washington counties besieged by Bigfoot hunters with high-powered rifles have gone ahead and imposed their own fines, $10,000 or a 5-year jail sentence. In a roundabout way, the kill camp says their interest is also to protect Bigfoot, because they have to haul one in to bring science on board and then get that coveted endangered species status. For the sake of the species, they say, one must fall. In kill circles, this hypothetical sacrificial Bigfoot is known as the martyr. Capital M. Bigfoot hunters point out that this is precisely what happened with the giant panda. Known only to Westerners as a mythical black and white beast since the mid-19th century, the panda eluded all field expeditions for decades. Eventually, in 1924, one was killed and brought back to New York, allowing the panda to enter the scientific lexicon. Coincidentally, it turns out that the man who pulled the trigger on the panda was Teddy Roosevelt's son, Kermit. It was before the frog, so it was normal at that time. Kermit was also an adventuring hunter, but like his father, Kermit became convinced of the need to preserve wild habitats. Fittingly, the panda has since become the symbol of the conservation movement as the logo of the World Wildlife Fund and everybody's favorite cuddle partner. This is what Michael Rugg hopes exactly will happen with Bigfoot. Rugg just finished building his museum, the Bigfoot Discovery Project in Santa Cruz, California, which he conceived as an ode to the intersection between Roosevelt's conservationism and Bigfoot. Roosevelt stopped here in his wildlife odyssey as president in 1903, Rugg told me when I reached him at the office. Roosevelt, of course, came to environmentalism through hunting. That's part of the moral of the teddy bear story, when TR refused to shoot a chained animal. In the early 20th century, the teddy bear itself was an icon of wildlife preservation. And we're saying that Bigfoot should be equally important to the cause, another goodwill ambassador from the natural world. Even if TR wanted to shoot Bigfoot, Rugg says, he believes the goal in the end was preservation. TR both hunted and created our national parks, he pointed out. And he added, TR understood that we need to maintain the forest for their majestic animals, including Bigfoot, and we at the Bigfoot Discovery Project want to honor that foresight. Why not, I say. One of the species of elk that Roosevelt took down on that Dakota trip back in 1884 was later named after him. Cervus roosevelti officially entered mammalogy texts in 1897, giving America's grandest deer the name of the man who first brought one back for the anatomists. And perhaps a similar opportunity awaits, because Grover Krantz died before the taxonomic name for Bigfoot could be settled. No one has yet even proposed the specific name, which is the second part of scientific terminology that identifies the species itself. I suggested to Rugg that if they do find a specimen that satisfies the scientific community, maybe Bigfoot should be named after its most famous hunter. Not a bad idea, he said. Gigantopithecus roosevelti, I said. I like it, he said approvingly. A noble name for a noble creature. There he is. Thank you.
Yeah, can I actually...
There you go.
Thanks.
This is John Hodgman and Jonathan Colton, the taking turns on the asthma inhaler here.
Really is getting very thin in here. Some of these candles are sputtering.
Yeah, well, then I should just very quickly say, Little Grey Book Lecture, number 31, June 16, 7:30 p.m. on how to commit the perfect crime.
And either you'll find us doing that show or you'll find us dead in the safe.
Wait. Hang on a second. I just remembered, if we can find some way before the candle goes out to light the asthma inhaler on fire, it'll be an explosive and we might be able to blow the safe open.
It's a great idea because it is very flammable.
So let me just go over that. The last candle went out there.
That was the last candle.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll find another way out. But we hope to see you at the lecture in any case, Thursday night at 7:30 p.m.
And he was perfect. John Adams kept us out of war with France. Jefferson made a Louisiana Purchase. In 1812, James Madison kicked the British in the pants. James Monroe told Europe they could suck it. John Quincy Adams looked just like his dad. Andrew Jackson got rid of all the Indians. Van Buren served one term, but he wasn't bad. William Henry Harrison died early. John Tyler annexed Texas from Mexico. James K. Polk fought Mexico to keep it. Taylor was a Mexican war hero. Fillmore gave a boat to Commodore Perry. Pierce repealed the Missouri Compromise. Buchanan saw the Civil War's beginning. And Lincoln saved the Union, then he died. Johnson just survived impeachment. General Grant enjoyed a drink or two. Rutherford B. Hayes ended Reconstruction. Garfield was assassinated in 1882. Everybody, Arthur suspended Chinese immigration. Cleveland made the railroad people squirm. Harrison signed the Sherman Antitrust Act. Then Grover Cleveland served another term. McKinley kicked the Spanish out of Cuba. Roosevelt was handy with a gun. Taft was big and fat and had a mustache. Wilson kicked some ass in World War I. Harding said let's laissez-faire with business. Coolidge let the roaring 20s roar. Hoover screwed the pooch in the Great Depression. Roosevelt beat the Nazis in a war, and now...
We're almost there.
Truman dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Eisenhower kept commies well in hand. Kennedy was killed by a magic bullet. Johnson murdered kids in Vietnam. Nixon was a sweating, filthy liar. Ford gave Nixon pardon for his crimes. Carter lusted in his heart for peanuts. And Reagan won the Cold War and lost his mind. George Bush Sr. poked at Saddam Hussein. Clinton gave an intern a cigar. W's legacy is a work in progress. That is all the president so far. In the year 2005, we're out of money. Somewhere surely freedom's on the march. And I don't like to make political statements. March band.